Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Ross Camidge, and to begin, I asked him about a patient from his practice.
The first guy I've actually known almost as long as I've been in Colorado, so he's now 55, and I first met him back in 2006, where he thought he'd had pneumonia, and then they had the usual workup, and he was what appeared to be a stage one cancer, which was resected. It was a 3.6 centimeter invasive cancer. Back in the days when we used to call it bronchoalveolar carcinoma, node negative, that was resected January 2006. Because it was node negative, it was 3.6 centimeters, he had no additional adjuvant therapy, and we just followed him. And actually followed him for 8 years, and then he got bored of me, and then he just sort of disappeared from follow-up.
Could I just ask one thing I noticed here in his history that's kind of interesting? So he was a smoker, but he was still smoking.
Yeah. No, I mean, he's a great guy. He's a rough diamond. He's definitely kind of like, yeah, doc, yeah, I know I should give up the smoking. And then, you know, he's got the packet of cigarettes in his top pocket. So he tried and failed to quit multiple times.
Wow.
But, you know, he's a nice guy. And we reached a detente in terms of me trying to sort of nag him too much on that.
Just kind of gave up on it after a while, huh? That's really amazing, though.
Well, it's really interesting because then what happened is something like 12 or 13 years after he's first diagnosed, he said, I just felt, you know, I should go back into a follow-up. And I went, well, what happened? He said, well, you know, I was moving this refrigerator and felt I pulled something. And of course, he comes in, he has a chest scan, and now suddenly there's a right-sided pleural effusion, there are lymph nodes in the middle of his chest, and there are nodules in his right lung. We get a PET scan, and there's stuff everywhere, including with peritoneal spread, the lymph nodes all light up, these nodules light up, and he gets a biopsy. And I'm thinking, gosh, this has to be a second cancer, you know, 12, 13 years later. And not only is it the same cancer, but we prove it by doing molecular testing. He has an ALK gene rearrangement, a rare one. He has something called a HIP1 ALK fusion rather than a traditional EML4. We went back to the 2006 specimen, exactly the same gene rearrangement. Interestingly enough, that diagnosis of stage 4 cancer, he quit smoking in a heartbeat.
Wow.
He just needed the right motivation.
Wow.
Brain scan was clear. And so we're in this situation where suddenly, you know, this was happening in about October 2019. We had these two competing data sets. We had Alex, which I was involved with. So obviously, Alectinib had become the standard thing you would go for. But we were in between the two interim analyses for the ALTA-1L study, which was the Brigatinib versus Crizotinib study. And so I could sit down with this guy who I'd got to know over nearly a decade and say, look, here's the data. Which one are we going to start you on? And at that point in time, which was before we saw the second interim analysis, I said, look, the data so far, these things look about equivalent. One is maybe a little bit better tolerated than the other. One is one pill a day. The other is eight pills a day. And he kind of looked at me with that. Okay, why are you even telling me this? I'm going to have one pill a day. I'm going to have the one that's slightly better tolerated. And then we'll worry about, you know, forget about the science. We'll do the rest later. So he started on Brigatinib. Tolerated it fine. As I said, he quit smoking, and he's responding on his first scan.
So no tolerability issues at all?
No, none.
Nothing whatsoever. So I guess the first question is about the biology of this to start with. He's a smoker, but he has ALK, and he has a recurrence all these years later. Have you ever seen anything like this, and any thoughts about it?
So the smoker, yes. I mean, I don't buy into the thing that you should only test never smokers. If you have non-small cell lung cancer, I'm going to test you from a molecular driver because we're constantly surprised. The hit rate is absolutely less. But, you know, I've had people who absolutely do not fit that textbook definition. You know, they're older, they have comorbidities, they're heavy smokers. You know, in this guy, he's a current smoker, and yet they're ALK positive. So it's surprising, but it's not undescribed. In terms of the biology, yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a relapse that happens more than a decade afterward and it's still the same cancer. He must just have a relatively slow-moving cancer.
So, yeah, what a really amazing case. And I guess the other thing here that you were alluding to is the choice that you have. Can you talk about right now what data we have in the first-line setting for patients with ALK disease?
So I've been giving this quite a lot of thought over the last couple of months. So in general, the first thing you should say is when you actually try and compare like with like, the similarity between the first-line efficacy data for alectinib and for brigatinib is incredibly similar. I mean, it's almost freakishly similar. So, yeah, you can play the game by saying, you know, look at my investigator-assessed endpoint, look at my independent radiology review-assessed endpoint. But when you try and compare like with like, here is the data. So the IRC-assessed hazard ratio for alectinib when it was first done was 0.5. It was 0.49 for brigatinib. If you look at the investigator-assessed hazard ratio at the updated data analysis, it was 0.43 for alectinib. It was 0.43 for brigatinib. If you look at the two-year progression-free rate by the investigator, it was 56% for alectinib. It was 56% for brigatinib. And the only thing that there's a subtle difference is the point estimate of the median progression-free survival by the investigator. It was something like 34 months with alectinib, and it was something like 29 months with brigatinib, but the confidence intervals overlap. And there's no doubt that that one of the data sets that all look identical, the one where they look different, people will use to sort of say these things are different. But there is nothing really to say these things are different in terms of the efficacy in the first-line setting. So in terms of choices, I think you can approach it in a couple of different ways, and you have to kind of decide what kind of a physician you are. If you are going to give, so you almost have to project into the future, if you are going to give your patient lorlatinib in the second line setting, which is what the NCCN guidelines say, it's almost what the FDA indication is, then you literally have a head-to-head choice between alectinib and brigatinib. The only differences are, when you look at quality of life, alectinib was unable to show a statistically significant difference over crizotinib, but brigatinib could. And the other is the pill burden. Now, I've talked to patients and they go, pill burden doesn't matter. I'm talking about a life-threatening disease. Why do I care if I take, you know, 100 pills a day or one? And you go, well, that's fine if I said the only way you can stay alive is 100 pills a day. You'll take it. But I offered you a choice. Most people would probably take one pill a day.
So alectinib is 8 pills a day. Brigatinib is one.
Yeah. And the tolerability compared to crizotinib, the only one that's actually shown a statistically significant improvement is brigatinib. Alectinib looked the same. And that's certainly my clinical experience. Brigatinib is a somewhat better tolerated drug than alectinib. These are all pretty good tolerated drugs, though.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you about your clinical experience. Because, you know, initially I had this thought that alectinib was no problem at all, like zero problems. And then I started to hear stuff, I don't know, edema or whatever, but what do you actually see?
So some people, you know, I mean, there are people who will have the worst possible drug and they have no side effects. And there are people who you give the drug that everyone else tolerates and they have terrible side effects. But in general, most people on alectinib are still aware that they're taking a medication. They get peripheral edema. They often get exaggerated skin photosensitivity, which varies, you know, depending on where you are in the world and what season you're in. Brigatinib, I would say occasionally people can get some achiness associated with it. You can certainly get myalgia with alectinib, probably a little bit more exaggerated. And then, I mean, I would say in general, if our goal is perfect control of disease and normal quality of life, brigatinib gets closer to that in most people than alectinib does.
So the one other thing that sort of sticks out there that we've been hearing about are these so-called pulmonary reactions. And I see that this man, it looks like he was involved in a study looking at that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. So these had been described. They're running about something like 5% of people get any kind of respiratory symptoms with brigatinib. About 3% get something severe. So unless you're treating 30 patients a year, you're unlikely to see this. It's very specific. It's literally happening on the second or third day that you go on it. And the amazing thing is this is not the pneumonitis that we associate with other TKIs. If you go on it and you get it and you stay on the drug, if you can tolerate staying on the drug, within 4 or 5 days, they will all disappear. It has a completely different pathophysiology. And we've done this study. We haven't presented it publicly yet, but what I can tell you, because this guy contributed to it, is if you actually do pulmonary function tests, everybody's DLCO, their ability to transfer oxygen, drops very briefly on day two, and then it normalizes. And so I think the people who are getting the symptoms are the people who don't tolerate that 10 or 20% drop in DLCO for a few days. And that's what you do. So we didn't know who was going to happen, but if Mrs. Jones is a respiratory cripple when she walks through the door, you could say, brigatinib may not be the drug for you. Or if you do it, you do a shallower step up. 30, 60, 90, and then 180, and they tolerate it just fine.
And at this point, what's your hypothesis about the pathophysiology?
We don't know. We've got a nice collaboration going on with Cambridge University in the UK, and they're starting to analyze these CT scans that we're doing on day two in the study, and they think there's an increase in vascular density. So they're wondering if there's some vasospastic thing which then you rapidly tolerize to. And brigatinib is one of the drugs that does have some hypertension associated with it, so maybe it has some vascular effects.
Interesting. And clinically, what do patients actually say?
So if you're in the severe, you know, you literally feel like your chest is incredibly tight. But probably half of them have, you know, mild to moderate, and they just, you literally have to drag the information out of them. It's just sort of like, well, I felt a little tight, and then I just ignored it and it went away.
So it sounds like it's not a big concern from your point of view.
No, not at all. I mean, the scariest thing is a severe side effect that's unpredictable. I think this is a side effect which is 100% predictable because it happens in everybody and you can predict who can tolerate it. And then when you think about the pathophysiology, you just want to reassure the patient that if they can tough it out for 4 or 5 days, it'll just go away.
So you mentioned lorlatinib also. Can you talk about what we know about that and where we are today in terms of second and third line therapy for these patients?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, if you decide you're going to be a second-line lorlatinib person, then the ALTA-1L and the ALEX data is like, okay, so now we get to choose based on some of these more minor issues given the efficacy appears the same. But there is the concept of what are the lines of therapy you could use. So lorlatinib, given post and next-generation inhibitor, was originally reported as having a 40 to 50% response rate and a progression-free survival of about 5 or 6 months. There's a couple of things to pull out from that. The first is they've recently started to pull out the data, which I've been asking for a while, is to present intracranial efficacy separately from extracranial efficacy. We know that one of the real strengths of lorlatinib is it's amazing at getting into the brain. And when you do that, the response rates, if you have intracranial disease, are probably running 50 to 60%. And if you only have extracranial disease, the response rates are running in the kind of middle 30%.
That sounds kind of weird.
Well, no, because what's happening is in the brain is mostly a drug penetration issue. And if you have a drug that's really good at getting in there, your response rate acts as if it's an earlier line of therapy.
But why would it not work systemically?
Because there it's been exposed to the drug, so you've selected out a biological change in the cancer.
Wow, interesting.
I mean, it's really, I mean, we may go and talk about it with some of the later cases, but this whole idea about breaking the body down into intracranial and extracranial compartments is absolutely coming home to roost. The other thing is, on the lorlatinib data, there's very nice data that Alice Shore had led looking at your chance of responding to lorlatinib post a next generation inhibitor, depending on whether you could find a mutation in the ALK, a resistance mutation. If you did, the response rate was 60%. And if you didn't, it was 20%. So the concept of one ALK inhibitor followed by another one, followed by another one, certainly you can just play the numbers. But the hope is in the future, maybe we're going to be saying, okay, if you've got a mutation and we can find it, we feel confident this is the right approach. If we don't, maybe you're still going to try it and you're just going to be a bit more skeptical. But maybe we're going to find another group of things that we can do in the people who don't have a mutation. We will have a choice other than just going to lorlatinib. We've now seen examples of MET amplification or MET activation as an actionable second driver post the next generation ALK inhibitor. So I think the field is going to start to fragment.
I think MET also has been seen in people progressing with EGFR, you know, for example, in osimertinib. Do these patients respond to anti-MET therapy?
They do. So, yeah, MET is going to probably be up for the best supporting actor as a sort of secondary resistance driver. We've seen it in EGFR, and now we've seen it in ALK. And I think one of the things is as we've moved away from crizotinib, which is also a MET inhibitor, we expose that as a potential mechanism resistance. So what you do is you stay on your next generation ALK inhibitor and you add in crizotinib. Although the hope in the future is maybe we'll be using some of these next generation MET inhibitors, which, for example, also get into the brain, like tepotinib or capmatinib.
Wow. So have you tried that?
Yeah, we had a case at World Lung in 2019, really interesting case. So young woman in her 30s, diagnosed with ALK-positive lung cancer when she's in her third trimester, delivers the baby. We put her on alectinib. She has a great response for 3 months and then rapidly progresses. We try the brigatinib, then lorlatinib. Nothing's working. So clearly she's declaring herself as a second driver. It's not that she has an ALK resistance mutation. We couldn't find one. We looked for MET amplification and it was negative. We looked for MET exon 14 skip mutations, negative. But we were able to grow the cell lines and she had huge levels of MET signaling through a currently unrecognized method. But that was enough to say MET is important to that cancer. And we added in crizotinib and she's now about a year and has had a complete response, adding the MET into, in this case, brigatinib for her.
And you kept the electinib going?
Brigatinib, but yes, I kept it going because it was controlling some of her disease.
Wow. So she's on both?
Yeah, she is, tolerating it fine.
Wow, what a story. I'm not even going to ask you about this other mechanism, but just to try to keep it under control here, just to get more clinical. First of all, isn't there first-line data also with ceritinib?
Oh, it is, but I mean, I wouldn't waste a lot of time or effort on that. I think you get these drugs which are kind of proof of principle. Look, going onto a next-generation inhibitor was better than chemotherapy. Historically, it looks better than crizotinib, but nowhere near as good as either electinib or brigatinib. So, and also less well-tolerated. I mean, it was less well-tolerated than chemotherapy.
Sure.
So, ceritinib has a role in history, but that chapter was pretty short.
Right. So just to get back to second-line therapy, so it sounds like nowadays you could encounter a patient who starts out with first-line electinib, first-line brigatinib, and probably some people first-line crizotinib that are coming in with relapse. So how do you approach these three situations? And for a community-based oncologist, do you recommend any type of repeat mutation testing?
So the post-crizotinib, and there are, people go, well, this is nobody's starting on crizotinib, but there are people who've been on crizotinib for years and they're doing great. If they progress, it's very interesting. Even though electinib and brigatinib look almost identical in the first-line setting, in the post-crizotinib setting, they are dramatically different. Brigatinib has got nearly double the median progression-free survival as electinib. So presumably you select out a mechanism resistance on crizotinib that only brigatinib has the additional activity against. And so if you're progressing on crizotinib, probably brigatinib is the drug to go on to, and that's certainly within its license. If you progress on brigatinib, I think I personally would try and re-biopsy. And I think one of the problems is we're sending off next-generation sequencing panels. We're missing MET amplification in much of that. If you just want to shoot from the hip, try lorlatinib. But if they're not responding, it's not just, oh, I'm going to go onto another ALK inhibitor. Start to think that they might have a next-generation hole that you're missing. Start to think that maybe they have a second drive and you probably have to touch base with an expert center there. If they start on electinib, this was the other thing that I wanted to touch on. If you start on electinib, even though the drug that's licensed is lorlatinib, there is now data that brigatinib in that setting actually has some activity. There was a very small paper that came out that I think made people a little worried. There was about 23 patients in it, only had a 17% response rate. But we've now got data in probably more than 200 patients, and the response rate with brigatinib post a next generation inhibitor is running 50 to 70% with a PFS of 5 to 7 months. So very similar to lorlatinib, but better tolerated. So I think when I first saw the data from ALTA-1L, my first thought was, what I might do in my practice is start someone on electinib, then do brigatinib, then do lorlatinib. But I'd be, I'm in an academic center. I'd be re-biopsying and looking for mechanisms there.
So you also, in your write-up, talked about patients or trying to identify patients up front who maybe aren't going to do too well, so-called bad ALK. Like, what's that?
Well, so this is, where is the research field going to go? So we've talked about the clinical implications of ALEX and ALTA-1L and lorlatinib and everything else. But what research questions arise? Well, so one of the things is, starting to realize that you can't just play the numbers game. Brigatinib post-crizotinib looks better than electinib, but in the first line looks the same. What is going on? Probably if you're going in before a mechanism resistance is established, the cancer is much more pluripotential. It can just flip to some other mechanism. And so I think our hope that, constantly moving these things into the first line would extend our benefit may be a little disappointing that we're seeing. I think when you look at the curves, though, the other thing we're starting to realize is that maybe there's two broad populations of ALK. There is a group who is in a plateau of non-progression. They are about where the median occurs, which is why that number jumps around. And they are going years. They are, if you like, the good ALKs. And, they have an unmet need, but we're kicking that can way down the road. The immediate problem is the ones who are progressing in the sort of 12 to 16 months range, you know, before that median. And what is going on with them? Can we look at something up front that says you're more likely to be in the kind of bad ALK category, or BALK, as one of my colleagues calls it? Maybe it's going to be P53. Maybe it's going to be a variant. Maybe it's going to be something else. But if we could identify those risk factors up front, our potential to do clinical research in the first-line setting will be accelerated because our median in that group is going to be much shorter. Otherwise, we'd have studies that are going to look like breast cancer, and they're going to be out, you know, decades before we get the result.
So I'm curious at this point, now that we've seen these data roll out over the last few years, when you look at the agents, specifically alectinib and brigatinib, that have come out and, quote, beat crizotinib up front, how much of that is CNS and how much of it is, quote, being a better ALK inhibitor?
I think there's a combination of the two. There's no doubt that probably the reason why alectinib and brigatinib are so much better than ceritinib in the first line, a lot of that is to do with CNS activity. And the supportive data is if you look in that first-line ceritinib study, and you take the group that had no brain metastases, the median PFS of ceritinib is actually 2 years. It looks very similar to what we're seeing in these other studies. And its major Achilles heel is progression in the brain, even though it has some activity there. I think the idea of, you know, you have some degree of early clonal equipoise such that you suppress one of these mechanisms and something else pops up. It's not true equipoise. You do delay it. But I think that has shortened the degree of benefit that we thought we were going to get. So I think absolutely CNS is very important, and that has contributed a lot to the benefit of these drugs. And then some of it is trying to suppress mechanisms of resistance. But if you can't suppress 100%, it's always going to find a way through.
So I want to mainly focus on targeted therapy in our discussion, but sort of related to that and maybe related to your patient is the issue of immunotherapy in patients who have driver mutations. And I know you were part of this immunotarget registry, but I'm just kind of curious in general where we are today in understanding the role of checkpoint inhibitors in these patients, checkpoint inhibitors plus chemotherapy. And also, you know, with your patient here, you know, history, a lot of smoking. Do you view that patient differently than you would somebody else?
I mean, some of these questions we don't have answers to. What we do know is that the degree of benefit from immunotherapy doesn't appear uniform across lung cancer. And some of the clues of the group which will derive less benefit and sometimes even no benefit are whether they have a driver oncogene. Now, that's a confounded variable because patients with a driver oncogene often tend to have a lower tumor mutation burden. They often tend to be never smokers, so we can't quite pull it apart. I would say the gene rearrangement diseases, ALK, ROS1, RET, are the best group for saying the least amount of benefit from immunotherapy. Some of them were explicitly excluded from some of our classical first-line studies with immunotherapy. For that reason, some of them just weren't analyzed. In the immunotarget, which was an international study, relatively small numbers, but there was still for monotherapy with a PD-1 or PD-L1 agent, there was a 0% response rate in ALK. We're actually in the process of taking the small numbers of people who responded in RET and ROS1 and drilling down on them in detail. Because the question you want to ask is, look, is there really a 10% response rate in ROS1? Or is the one patient out of your 10 who responded, were they a false positive on the ROS1 testing? Were they a heavy smoker, as you said? You know, did they not respond to the ROS1 inhibitor before they went on the immunotherapy? And that's what we're in the process of doing.
But you said something that I don't believe I've heard before, which is separating out the fusions versus the, what, activating mutations in terms of immunotherapy?
Yeah. So, I mean, EGFR is a good example. So EGFR mutations have, in general, less benefit from immunotherapy, but it's not zero. There are clearly EGFR mutant patients who responded. And again, if you look at the data set, the hazard ratio in whatever you were comparing it to was always less with the EGFR mutants. Sometimes it wasn't statistically significant, but it wasn't on the other side of the line usually in the forest plot. Usually it still was deriving some degree of benefit. That doesn't seem to be the case with the gene rearrangements. it's still somewhat a work in progress. The other example is, you know, KRAS is an oncogene-driven disease in many patients. They're deriving benefit. BRAF is an oncogene-driven disease. They're deriving benefit. And MET-exon 14 is kind of somewhere in the middle again because it's a heterogeneous population. Some are never smokers, some are heavy smokers.
That's really interesting. I remember in a previous conversation, you referred to patients who had very, very high PD-L1 levels with ALK.
Yeah.
Any more follow-up on that?
So PD-L1, this is the problem, is that when we're using PD-L1 as a predictive biomarker, we're making assumptions. We're saying PD-L1 is up because it's induced to go up by gamma interferon secreted by activated T cells who are sniffing around the cancer trying to kill it. However, in many of the driver oncogenes, PD-L1 is up in the absence of infiltrating T lymphocytes. So it's up for some reason downstream of the oncogene, and there its predictive potential is zero because it's not telling you that there are T lymphocytes there. And I think one of the things that might improve the predictive potential of PD-L1 is to combine it with some very basic immunohistochemistry and say, are there lymphocytes there? And that's coming.
So for practical purposes at this time, with not all the information we'd like to have, which is a situation we're in, seems like a lot, I am curious when you start thinking about, if at all, checkpoint inhibitors in patients with targetable lesions, for example, in ALK. Do you use them at all? Do you use it with chemo? How do you approach it?
So I would say, with the exception of the driver oncogenes, which are traditionally associated with a heavy smoking population, BRAF and KRAS being the obvious examples, in the other ones, I tend to deprioritize immunotherapy to about the level of a Hail Mary pass. And the issue when you're thinking about going on to chemotherapy as to whether you do chemo-immuno or just the chemo actually relates to whether you plan to keep the TKI going. Now you go, that's crazy. Didn't we already have, you know, that study that you didn't need to keep the TKI going when you went on to chemo for EGFR mutant? And we did. It was the IMPRESS study. But one of the reasons why we might want to keep it going now is these drugs are, as we've mentioned, better at getting into the brain. And maybe what they're doing is preserving CNS control. There's a few small studies came out at ASCO. We have our own data that actually keeping the TKI going prolongs the PFS when you go on to chemotherapy, and maybe it's mostly because you're preventing progression in the brain. And if that's the case, TKIs and immunotherapy don't combine well, so that's the other reason why I'm tending to add in chemotherapy and keep the TKI going rather than stopping it and going on to chemoimmunotherapy.
Let me think that one through a little bit. So I guess one of the things that you hear about, you mentioned the differentiation between, you know, for example, EGFR versus ALK. What do you do when you decide that the patient who's got an EGFR activating mutation no longer responsive to targeted therapy? First of all, do you even look at the PD-L1 level in making your decision?
No, I don't.
And you hear people talking about using the MPower 150 combination of atezo, paclitaxel, carbo, and bev.
So the MPower 150 is the great example of how we're all flawed human beings, and you'd be surprised how many people, they want to give the MPower 150 regime, but they don't want to give a taxane. So they give carbo, pem, bev, pembro, and they sort of jerry-rig something. So you go from a somewhat suspect small subgroup analysis that you could pull apart, you know, if you look at the paper, to a completely data-free zone, and we just do it because we don't want to give a taxane.
The issue of whether to use a taxane as part of first-line treatment of metastatic disease for non-squamous also comes up with the MPower 130 trial of carbo, nab-paclitaxel, and atezo, which, like the 150 regimen, is approved first-line by the FDA for patients without EGFR ALK genomic alterations with non-squamous cancer. So potentially you have the option of either paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel. But let's get back to the patient with an EGFR activating mutation progressing on osimertinib, no new mutations, and you're moving away from targeted treatment. What are you usually thinking about?
Well, so let's say they were progressing through targeted therapy. What I would tend to do is keep the osimertinib going, and I would add in carboplatin and pemetrexed or carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab, and I would keep the TKI going. And I realize I can't stand up in court and say I can defend this action, but you ask me what I do. That's what I do.
And again, even with the EGFR, you're holding off PD-1 for Hail Mary.
Exactly. So I think if I did that and they were progressing, literally I say, look, your chance of benefit is about your chance of severe side effects. And so it really is like, you know, rolling the dice, and it's, you know, it's not quite kill or cure, but it is in the Hail Mary thing. And, you know, I have to be honest, most of the time it doesn't work and you don't get terrible side effects and they don't respond either. So there's a big middle ground. But I have had people who've had terrible side effects, and I personally have not yet had anyone respond, but I have a number of colleagues who have.
And getting back to this idea of keeping the TKI going, another thing we've been hearing about, I wasn't aware of until fairly recently, is the issue of, I guess, delayed TKI toxicity and patients are getting immune therapy. What about that?
Yeah, so maybe one of the things you're talking about is, you know, Mrs. Jones walks through the door, you haven't got the molecular testing back and you're starting her on, you know, carbo-pem-pembro, and then you suddenly find out that they've got an EGFR mutation and you say, I'm going to stop that, I'm going to stick you on osimertinib, and they start to get problems because their immunotherapy is still in their system. And, you know, one of my colleagues has described that as sort of poisoning the well. And there's certainly a move amongst some of us in the field to say, look, if you don't have that information back, and particularly if the patient is a never smoker and you don't really know or you're suspicious, don't include the immunotherapy in cycle one. Just give them chemo, wait for the results to come back, no driver oncogene, add in the pembro in cycle two.
So let's move on now. I've always been interested in the exon 20 insertions and hoping that at some point we're going to be able to do something about it. And it sounds like we're getting there. How about your 53-year-old lady?
So, delightful lady, 53-year-old Korean-American. She'd met her husband when he was over there in the military. First diagnosed in about July 2017, presenting with the sort of usual non-resolving cough. You know, went through the usual sort of workup. But eventually they get imaging and she has bilateral nodules, liver lesions, a dominant mass about 5 centimeters in the right lower lobe. She gets a PET scan and she also has bone lesions as well. A brain scan and she has multiple brain lesions, probably 20 or so at a guess. And she gets a biopsy, CT-guided biopsy of the lung, TTF1 positive adenocarcinoma, but with an exon 20 insertion. Interesting enough, since we were talking about it, PD-L1 of 70%, but I discount that. She's a never smoker. She has a driver oncogene. So there are multiple different exon 20 insertions. Hers was a 766 to 769 duplication. The nomenclature is hard to get your head around. I think if this becomes relevant, we'll learn it. But at the moment, we're just lumping them all together. But there are subtle differences. Initially goes on carboplatin and pemetrexed and has SRS to 18 lesions in her brain. And she does okay, goes from about August 2017 to about April 2018 with a nice response, so a good response that lasts for a long time until she has some progression in her lungs. At that point in time, we have the trial of TAC-788, which is one of these drugs being developed for exon 20 insertions. And so she goes on that in May 2018. The snowstorm of nodules in her lungs, which had been emerging from the mist, dramatically shrinks down. Her breathing gets much better, but at pretty much the first scan, so she started in May and in June, suddenly she has new lesions within her brain. And she has logged as progression in the study, so she has a very short median progression-free survival per the study. We're still desperately trying to avoid whole brain radiotherapy in these patients who we think might live a long time. So she gets 39 additional lesions treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. Her body scan, her extracranial response, is maintained. She stays on the drug in the study until now, somewhere between June and December, so about 6 months later, 15 new lesions are turning up in her brain. Again, we treat those with stereotactic radiosurgery, but she is starting to cognitively decline. Whole brain radiotherapy treats everything, but if you treat enough lesions by stereotactic radiosurgery, there is some impact. You slow the computer down, and she was starting to slow. We put her on Ritalin, which perked her up a little bit. And then, unfortunately, she was starting to progress in both the body and the brain. She had symptoms in the brain. She had bad headaches. And we had a very full and frank discussion between myself, the radiation oncologist, her husband, and herself. Look, if we give you whole brain radiotherapy, we could produce radiation dementia. You know, you've had a lot of lesions treated by SRS, you've got some cognitive impairment already, but you are getting symptoms from this disease in the brain. And she said, well, okay, I'm going to try it. And she had a terrible outcome, I have to tell you. Literally within 2 weeks of finishing the whole brain radiotherapy, She entered a cognitive decline. She withdrew. She didn't have any symptoms, but she had left us and then died about 4 weeks later. And I spoke to the husband a lot afterwards, and we had this long discussion about, was it the right or the wrong thing to do? And this is the way we rationalized it. What he did by supporting her when she went through the whole brain radiotherapy was to take the burden of her disease onto himself. He became the carer. She didn't have any symptoms. She wasn't distressed by this. He was the one distressed. And that helped him deal with the horrible situation. It allowed him to think that he had made the sacrifice, even though his wife left him technically earlier than she might have done cognitively.
Could you talk about that a little bit more?
I mean, so for those who've seen it, you know, radiation dementia is one of the saddest things that you ever get to see. I mean, literally, people withdraw, they stop eating, they are gone even though they're physically still there. And that was very tough for the husband to go through because he suddenly became, you know, the complete carer. I mean, he had to lift her in and out of wheelchairs and take her to the bathroom and everything else. And he worried that he'd done the wrong decision to push for the whole brain radiotherapy rather than letting her suffer with the raised intracranial symptoms that she had. And, you know, if you can go back in the time machine, you always wonder if you'd make the same decision. And the way we allowed him to come to peace with that decision was to say, we took the symptoms away from his wife and we shifted the burden of the disease from her onto him because he now had to be the carer. And that was okay. He was the guy that said, you know, if I could make the disease happen to me. And I said, that's kind of what you did. But it was a very tough situation.
Wow. Well, let's get back to the medical parts of this. And I'll mention that in the past, we've gone to the Society of Neuro-Oncology to do meetings on glioma. We did one on targeted therapy of brain mets. Can you imagine? And then I did an hour and a quarter interview with Greg Riley about it. So that's oncology, an hour and a quarter on targeted therapy of brain mets. But anyhow, this case certainly brings up a lot of questions. My mouth is still dropping from the 18 lesions that had SRS moving up to 35, et cetera. So that's the first question, which is, you know, I thought you don't go beyond 4 or maybe 10. What's your experience?
Well, so there isn't one answer. I mean, we are constantly in the process of pushing the envelope. I think in this case, we pushed it too far. I think, you know, there are other people who have had 100 lesions treated by SRS and have no side effects. So there's something to do with her biology that her normal brain parenchyma was just suffering more with this. So it's not just to do with the number of lesions. We have certainly shown in publications from our center that, you know, you can treat, you know, tens of lesions and get good control and preserve cognitive function in most people. So we are very much trying to avoid that whole brain radiotherapy because people are now living long enough that they might manifest radiation dementia from it. I think the other exciting thing here is kind of what you were hinting at with Greg speaking at the SNO meeting is the concept of really defining the brain as a battleground properly. So Nancy Lin, Patrick Wen, and myself are some of the architects of the RANO guidelines or the RANO brain metastases guidelines. And one of the things that came out in the most recent set of guidelines, which came out in January 2018, was really how do you define studies? We've done lots of retrospective kind of cobbled together the data, but really prospectively define it. And the TAC 788 study, I think, is a great example of that. If you look at the data that they presented at World Lung in 2019, they presented the median progression-free survival by whether you did or didn't have brain metastases at baseline. And one was 3 months, and the other was 8 months. And presumably this patient contributed to that data set. This is telling you this drug has an overt liability in the brain. And it is much better to find that out early because they allowed some untreated asymptomatic brain metastases in, because now it means when you do the studies going forward, you should be very strict. You should be, as in those guidelines, what's called scenario A, and you should say you can only come into the study if you have no brain metastases or your brain metastases are treated, because it's an overt liability of the drug. The other side is like the lorlatinib study we talked about, where if your drug has an amazing activity in the brain, what you want to do is capture that data as robustly as you can. That's called scenario B in the guidelines. And that means you've got to have regular brain MRIs. You've got to capture the response rate in the brain separately from the response rate in the rest of the body. So we're in a brave new world.
Really interesting. Another thing that came out that I thought was interesting at the SNO meeting was the issue of whether you can decrease the morbidity from whole brain radiation. And we polled the audience and the faculty. It was very interesting, the disparity we saw about the use of hippocampal sparing, and I think it's called memantine, the drug.
Yeah.
It was really split. There were people using both of these things, not using them, Memorial wasn't, whatever. But what's your take on that?
I think if you have to give whole brain radiotherapy, most people would try and spare the hippocampus because that's where most of your memory sits. To be honest, it's not absolute sparing. It's relative sparing. These beams are all going everywhere. There is some suggestion that it has a somewhat better preservation of brain. One of the studies that I referenced earlier, where we looked at people who'd had multiple doses of SRS, is we actually calculated the dose to the hippocampus if you'd had 20 lesions treated by SRS versus whole brain versus hippocampal sparing whole brain. The dose to the hippocampus is way lower if you have stereotactic radiosurgery, because hippocampal sparing it's a relative sparing. It's really not completely doing it. The memantine is really interesting. I thought when I saw your results, the way it was mostly split was whether you're a radiation oncologist or a medical oncologist. It seems like the radiation oncologists kind of have bought into memantine and the medical oncologists are like, nah.
Yeah, it's interesting. So getting back to these exon 20 insertions, can you talk a little bit more about the biology? My understanding is these are activating mutations just like exon 19, et cetera, since we haven't had drugs for them. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's exactly. The biggest challenge is structurally, they look very, very similar to the wild type form of the EGFR. So the biggest challenge is being able to inhibit them in a tolerable way. If you remember the story with afatinib, that in the lab it could inhibit T790M, but you could never get up to the doses that would do it in a person because the inhibition of the EGFR wild type, which occurred at a much lower concentration, said you could never get there. For exon 20, it's the same problem, but they're very, very close. I mean, so with afatinib, you know, you had the situation that you were having to go through EGFR wild type to get to T790M. With exon 20 and some of these drugs, they're about in equipoise. So you're always going to get some side effects. What's happening with TAK788 is, you know, you don't have to have more side effects than you have to. With poziotinib, if you like the proof of principle drug, it still had more activity against EGFR wild type than it did against exon 20. So it tended to have more in the way of side effects. Poziotinib's dose reduction rate at its recommended dose is about more than 60%. TAK788 is about 25%. And why does that matter? Because presumably it will influence not just the response rate, but the duration of response, the PFS, etc.
So in terms of benefit, is it kind of similar, a waterfall plot, duration response to what you see with the more conventional ones?
Well, it's not quite there yet. We're running about a 40 to 50% response rate, median PFS. Again, here it was influenced by the presence or absence of brain mets, but if you didn't have brain mets, it was about 8 months. So it's getting there. It's not quite the same as saying, I've got an L858R and I'm going to go on osimertinib. It's not quite that good yet. I think 788 is looking the more promising of the pack. Poziotinib, I think, has sort of definitely got people excited about the field, but lots of challenges in terms of its tolerability. And at least when they've moved it outside from MD Anderson and people are using it in the real world, its response rate seems to be dropping too.
In terms of tolerability, is it kind of like afatinib? In other words, worse than erlotinib and way worse than osimertinib type thing? Or where does it fit in?
I would say TAK788 is probably similar to afatinib. I would say poziotinib is worse than afatinib.
Hmm. And in terms of the old IPASS bar, do you think this drug is ready for first-line, or these drugs, or any of these drugs are ready for first-line therapy?
When you've got about a 40 to 50% response rate, that's kind of on the fence as to whether that's really better than first-line chemotherapy or chemoimmunotherapy.
Yeah, I've heard people talking about 60% as the bar they want to hit.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know that we're really getting there. And one of the things is, as I hinted, you know, some of these exon 20 insertions may be different. And so we think we're comparing like with like, but even if you look in the kind of, you know, the preclinical data, so for example, there's something called a D770 insertion versus a V774 insertion. One is nearly twice as sensitive as the other one. And so these things could influence that response rate. It might influence the group that you want to use these first line. At the moment, I'm tending to use them second line unless you've got a patient who, for whatever reason, you think chemo is not a good deal. But this is not a free lunch either in terms of its side effects.
I want to ask you also about NTRK fusions. We just did a survey of 77 general medical oncologists. It was really looking at the kind of assays that they're doing. This is actually breast, colon, and prostate cancer, but I was amazed at the volume of NGS that was going on. And they're finding NTRK, they're finding MSI, they're finding all kinds of PARP stuff. I was really amazed what's going on in practice. I asked you if you had anybody who had an NTRK fusion. You said no, but maybe you can talk a little bit about where we are right now with that.
So two things. So I think we predicted maybe back in 2010, 2011, that once you got past four analytes, you got to the tipping point in the health economics that actually doing a panel was cheaper than doing individual analytes. So we are totally there with lung cancer. We are getting there with many other tumor types. So that doesn't surprise me that people are, you know, checking the box and say, go look for everything in your panel. I think we will have to start to know what's in the panel. You know, there's a SNOM value. I don't care if you have 400 genes or 20 genes. I just need to make sure you include the genes which actually drive our oncogenes. Most of that's just kind of, you know, baggage, you know, like all the things on a new car that you never actually use. I think what we've got here is with NTRK, I think what I told you is that we were one of the two sites along with Dana-Farber that first described NTRK gene rearrangements in non-small cell lung cancer. And so we have been very proactively looking for it even from the get-go. Initially, we developed a FISH assay, and then it became part of our next generation sequencing panel. But I have to tell you, in 3 or 4 years, we have not found another NTRK gene rearrangement in lung cancer. We found them in GBM. We found them in a few other kind of rare solid tumors, and they've gone into the study. But these things in lung cancer really are fantastically rare. I mean, I remember Alicia Sequist saying, you know, it's one per career.
Wow. From your point of view, what is an appropriate therapy for these patients, whether it's lung cancer or otherwise?
Well, yeah, the irony is we have this thing that you'd see one in your career, and you've got two drugs. You've got larotrectinib and entrectinib, and they both have 60 to 80% response rate. So you're kind of spoiled for choice. Larotrectinib got licensed slightly earlier. You know, I don't know there's much to choose between the two. I would try one, and if it didn't work, you've got the other one as a backup.
So let's talk about the other patients that you wanted to discuss here today, beginning with your 64-year-old man.
So this is, I guess I brought this one in because I wanted to make a point, almost like our first patient who was the heavy smoker who still had an ALK rearrangement. 64-year-old guy, 22-pack-year smoker. He presents with a seizure, actually in your neck of the woods in Florida. He was visiting family there. And he has a 3-centimeter lesion in his left occipital lobe, a 1-centimeter lesion in his left frontal lobe, and about a 1-centimeter in his left parietal lobe. They resect the occipital lesion, and it is TTF1 negative, P63 negative, P40 negative, so negative for almost everything. But they call it squamous based on the physical appearance of it. And so at least where he was in Florida, they said, well, there's no need. You know, you're a smoker. You've got squamous cancer. We're not going to do any molecular testing. He comes back to Colorado, which is where he lives, and he got a PET scan. And in addition to the stuff in his brain, he's got some Hiler activity, 4R lymph node activity, and with no CT correlate, but some activity in his left femur. Actually, interesting enough, it wasn't clear where the primary is. It was probably tangled up with the Hiler mass. He gets radiotherapy to the resection cavity and to SRS to the two other lesions in his brain. And the molecular testing comes back, and we do two next-generation sequencing panels. One is an RNA extraction and one is a DNA extraction. One is to look for MET exon 14 and gene fusions. One is to look for point mutations. But we also still do MET FISH testing because MET gene copy number is still the only thing that is a true gene copy number-driven driver. And I truly do not believe next-generation sequencing is the best way to pick that up. And on FISH testing, he had a MET-SEP7 ratio of 5, which is high. And that was not picked up by the NGS, but there it was on the FISH testing. We started on carbopaclitaxel. Pembro, he did pretty good on it. And then because he really had, outside of the stuff in his brain, fairly oligometastatic disease, we did consolidation radiotherapy after probably about 6 or 7 cycles. And then he's done fine, but a bit like the other lady, he's now starting to crop lesions in his brain. And the question is, where do we go next? His disease outside of his brain is well controlled. Maybe there's an issue in terms of if he was responding to the chemotherapy or the immunotherapy, it's not getting up there. I know he has potentially MET as a driver, so a high-level MET amplification ratio has about a 40 to 60% response rate to a MET inhibitor like crizotinib, but crizotinib's not going to get into his brain. So I have solicited for single-patient compassionate access to tipotinib, which he's going to get, and we'll see how it goes.
Tipotinib, what's that?
There are two next-generation MET inhibitors that are really chasing down to be the first one to get a MET exon 14 skip mutation license. And both of them have good activity, and both of them have some evidence of CNS activity too. One is capmatinib, and the other is tepotinib. I always remember that because it's like a teapot, tepotinib.
Right.
And I don't quite know why I went for tepotinib over capmatinib, but that's the one that we're going to try and get single-patient access to.
Interesting. Also interesting, it looks like he had a very good response.
Yeah, he did. He got carbopaclitaxel pembro.
And that also brings up the question of taxanes. You have both nab-paclitaxel and paclitaxel approved as first-line treatment for squamous combined with pembro and carbo. When we poll general medical oncologists in practice, we know that nab is used much more than by investigators. Perhaps up to half the patients in general medical oncology practice might get nab. So there's an approval and data with nab and paclitaxel. How do you make the decision?
I have to be honest, I don't use very much nab-paclitaxel unless somebody's having infusion reactions to paclitaxel. I tend to be sticking with the original taxanes.
And you also brought up the issue of testing in patients with, quote, squamous. This patient seems a little unusual, but what is your recommendation in that regard?
So I test. I got an email from a lady in New York who's ALK positive, you know, card-carrying ALK positive, proven by next-generation sequencing, responding to ALK inhibitors. But the histology is quoted as squamous. And so her doctor is saying, when you get onto chemo, I'm going to give you a taxane. I can't give you pemetrexed. And I said, well, that's nonsense. Pemetrexed is the chemotherapy that works best in ALK. Nobody's done the study as to pemetrexed in ALK-positive squamous cancer. So I think, you know, we have to be careful about the rules that we put in place that are not based on anything. So in terms of tolerability, in terms of efficacy, given this exaggerated sensitivity of pemetrexed in all of the gene rearrangement subtypes of lung cancer, I suggested she try that rather than jumping straight into paclitaxel or whatever they were going to give her.
You have another patient here, but it looks like it's another MET case, right?
It is. So the first one was MET amplification. This was a MET exon 14 skip mutation. And I wanted to bring this up because I said there's these two drugs, capmatinib and tepotinib and a few others that are chasing down the MET exon 14 first-line signal. And I think there's something really interesting going on here. It's almost kind of like what we talked about with the exon 20 drugs. The response rate that they're seeing are all in the 40 to 50% range. They're not in the 60 to 70% range that we're used to with EGFR and ALK. And they're sort of ignoring that elephant in the room and sort of rushing ahead and saying, you know, we can figure out whether this is a second-line drug or a first-line drug. But I actually think there's something much more interesting going on here. There was a really nice, I think, two or three papers now looking in patients with MET exon 14 skip mutations and A, showing some of them do not express the protein, which is in theory the mechanism of activation. MET exon 14 skip mutations remove something called the Cbl binding domain. You increase the half-life of the protein so it accumulates on the surface of the cell and it auto-aggregates and starts signaling. But some of these people don't have protein. So clearly that is not the driver. And some people, maybe about 10%, have a clearly identifiable other driver. Again, MET exon 14 was attempting to be a driver and somehow got subverted and the cancer used something else. Mostly we've seen KRAS mutations, but we've also seen EGFR mutations in ALK. And that means maybe some of that 40% response rate is your denominator is stuffed with people who actually aren't sensitive to MET inhibitors because they don't make the protein or they've got another driver oncogene. And I think when you look at the studies, capmatinib made a big deal out of the fact that their first-line study had a 70% response rate, but in the second line it had a 40% response rate like everyone else. And if you look at tepotinib, its response rate is 40 or 50%, whether it's in the first line or second line. So it's not that capmatinib is somehow a better drug. In these small studies, I think they just got lucky and had a few more of the people who are truly MET-driven. And the reason that matters is if somebody comes along with a much more definitive predictive biomarker, then the whole field gets shaken up. And I think that's what's going to come. I think you should get MET exon 14 genetic testing, and then you should at very least confirm it with MET protein expression. Because you don't want to waste someone's time with a treatment that's never going to work if that's not actually their driver.
Do you think that that's a feasible goal?
Yeah. I mean, I think what will happen is the companies who are going to be first to market will ignore me, which is totally fine. You know, their goal is to get their product licensed and to make money from it. Whoever is, you know, Johnny come lately with their third to market probably needs to invest a lot of money in developing a more specific predictive biomarker, because then they'll be able to claim their response rate is 70%. It's not because their drug's any better. They're just giving it to the right people. Imagine this is, you know, we go back in the time machine and you're developing a drug for EGFR and your predictive biomarker is EGFR FISH amplification. And then I'm coming up later and saying mine is an EGFR mutation. So maybe one gets licensed, has a 30% response rate, and I come in with a better diagnostic and I have a 70% response rate.
I actually remember that happening.
Yeah.
Right? That's the way
not long ago.
That was the case not too long ago, exactly what you said, right? I think there wasn't the adjuvant trial, I forget the name of it, was based on amplification of EGFR.
That was the Radiant trial. Yes, it was.
Right.
Good memory.
Got to ask you about KRAS.
Well, that's another great example. That fits in perfectly because what are we seeing? So on the one level, it's almost like we're seeing with poziotinib, proof of principle, we're getting responses. Suddenly KRAS G12C, we're getting responses. This is very exciting. But then it's starting to look a bit like more the MET exon 14. We're getting response rates of 40 to 50%. Some of the people are blowing through it. Some people are not responding at all. I don't think KRAS G12C alone is enough of a predictive biomarker. There are presumably contextual mutations that say whether this is enough to inhibit with a drug. It might be enough to get the drug licensed, but that's the beginning of the research. It's not the end of it.
So, yeah, as you were chatting about that, in terms of prediction of treatment benefit with these agents. So first of all, in terms of KRAS in general, I don't know. I've always thought about these patients just having these terrible tumors that nothing is going to work for. Is it really just another activating mutation, just one that we don't have a good drug for?
No, it's more complex than that. There's clearly heterogeneity. So, you know, if you sit in a lung cancer clinic, yeah, the general impression is KRAS patients do badly, but there will be some patients who do incredibly well. And some patients, even amongst the badly, who do super, super badly. We actually published a paper together with Vanderbilt, you know, even before these kind of co-mutations came out, just putting people into clinical syndromes. So we had a syndrome X, which was just like the worst thing. You had a KRAS mutation, and you also had to have a heavy smoking history, and you usually had soft tissue metastases. And their median survival was measured in weeks. The alternative was a group of people who tended to have a KRAS mutation, tended to have a lower smoking status, and tended not to have soft tissue metastases. And they could have amazing responses to pemetrexed. They could be alive for years. So KRAS alone is not enough to define a population as uniform.
Interesting. You know, I was also thinking when you were talking about predictors of treatment benefit to targeted therapy in terms of the vexing problem of predictors of benefit of immunotherapy. You mentioned tumor mutation burden, PD-L1. Any personal pet hypotheses about where this might end?
So there's some nice data that I think I've started to see presented in some studies. I've seen Naya Rizvi present some of this. Is, you know, take your population who is PD-L1 positive, but then the easiest way to now fragment it is based on the presence and the pattern of infiltration of CD8 positive lymphocytes. Because now we know there's a group of people who have no TILs, or the others are there and they're clustered at the edge of the tumor, or others where they're in there but not doing anything. And these undoubtedly are telling us something about the biology and other checkpoints that may be involved. And I think that's how we're going to need to present these as the very first thing. And we wrote a paper with Keith Kerr, who's a pathologist in Aberdeen in Scotland. And, you know, maybe this is his bias, but he was like, there's so much more we could do with just sort of basic immunohistochemistry to actually sort of define these into different groups because they look different down the microscope.
That's really interesting. Any thoughts about where combined immunotherapy, the regimen we've heard the most about has been Ipi-Nivo, but there are others out there in terms of where that's heading? And again, thinking about predictors, what kind of profile might match up with that?
So Ipi-Nivo, I think, is going to be a challenge in lung cancer. And you can't fault them for not doing a good study and not having all of the appropriate controls in there. The problem is that we have a fair bit of evidence, at least in lung cancer, that nivolumab is not as good as pembrolizumab. It has a series of negative first-line studies, and pembrolizumab has a series of positive first-line studies. The problem there is it now means that because Nivo is part of that backbone, this then becomes an uninterpretable regime. You know, is Nivo-Ipi just making Nivo alone as good as pembro? I mean, that's the challenge. I think it opens up the field to saying, can we add a CTLA-4 inhibitor to our preferred PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor, which wouldn't be nivolumab? And that's interesting. Again, you know, let's be honest, these additional checkpoints are not going to work in everybody. The immunotherapy field has been reluctant to consider the idea of personalized medicine until literally it was hammering on the door saying, look, guys, you spent $100 million and you have a negative study, and then suddenly they're interested. We will need predictive biomarkers to say, who needs CTLA-4? Who needs LAG-3? Who needs TIM-3? And that has to come.
That's a really interesting point, though, about the Nevo. I guess you're bringing up the question of Nevo makes me wonder, do you think other CTLA-4 PD-1 combinations maybe would be more successful than Ipi-Nivo? And again, I know there's some data that's coming out, you know, looking at durvalumab, and I think it's tremelimumab. Any thoughts about that?
I mean, there are some small phase 2 studies going on, but I think what people are starting to look at is, okay, add one of these things into pembrolizumab. That's what we really want to see. You know, is Ipi-Nivo, you know, if I be as uncharitable as possible, is Ipi-Nivo just a way of making inadequate Nivo almost as good as Pembro? I mean, and cost more and give you more side effects. I mean, that's the least charitable interpretation.
Are there studies looking at other CTLA-4 plus Pembro?
Yeah, they're small studies at present. They're not sort of registrational studies, but they're starting to explore that. But even if they're positive, it's not that adding in a CTLA-4 is going to work in everybody. And I think if you sort of said, you know, your problem is you don't have enough TILs, then CTLA-4 makes fine. If you've got a tumor stuffed full of TILs and they're just not working because of some other checkpoint, CTLA-4 is probably not going to do anything.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Camidge, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.